Let's start with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this time we have to consider this very significant research that was done by Christian men who believed in your word and believed that your word was truth and that there was an answer to some difficult problems. And they persevered, and you gave them great, amazing results. So we thank you for the Ray team. I just pray your richest blessing on all of them, on Steve Austin and on Larry Vardaman and on John Baumgartner and Russ Humphreys, everyone who worked on the team, and also Andrew Snelling and Don DeYoung. I just pray, Lord, for that the great research will have a significant impact on understanding the nature of your world and the veracity of your word. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, well, we're starting to get a group here collected. The first thing we want to ask ourselves the question is, what is RATE? And RATE is an acronym for radioisotopes and the age of the Earth. So it picks up the R from radioisotopes, okay, picks up this R, and then the age, skips the O, the Earth, so R-A-T-E. But it's also a very fortunate, or I should say providential acronym that the RATE team, before I even joined it, they were actually going for 4 years before I joined the RATE team. But what they were doing is they were looking at the whole issue of the rate of radioactive decay. And because the rate of radioactive decay, by today's standards, is such that when rocks are dated, if it is assumed, and that's what we're going to be looking at, if it is assumed that the rate of decay has always been the same, what we call a uniformitarian approach, then you end up with an old Earth. And so what they said was something quite radical. They said, well, the Bible teaches that the Earth is young, if we take it literally, and therefore the only answer is that there had to be some kind of a problem with radioisotopic decay. Either the first idea was that perhaps it really doesn't happen. And they first of all tested that, and they found out that it does happen. I'll go over the experiments with you. But and then the second thing was, since it does occur, the other possibility had to be that there was a period of time, and the RATE scientists believe that it was during the flood, that radioactive decay was accelerated by a factor of 100,000. And they actually have evidence for this. So they believe God, that the Earth was young, and they said, well, the only answer is we have to have accelerated decay. And so as we go through this, these are some of the opening issues. Conformity is the issue, the interaction between empirical evidence and the biblical text. And these are just some opening slides. Genesis 1:1 through 2:3 right now is at the interface of scripture and science. You know what's going on in the courts and everything else. Not to say anything more about that. So what is RATE? It is that the interaction, interface of scripture and science. Science, secular science, says one thing, and also old earth evangelicals, unfortunately, say the same thing. They believe the empirical evidence, and they accept the assumption that the rates have always been the same. And just throw this in there, what is fast? This is for tomorrow, a little commercial for tomorrow. It's also the interface of scripture and science now, but it's talking about the flood. That's all I'm going to say about fast. This is the scripture. This is a page from the Leningrad Codex, starting with Genesis 1:1, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz, Genesis 1:1. This is the three-column format of the Leningrad Codex. This is a complete Hebrew manuscript from AD 1009. It's the oldest complete manuscript. So we have the evidence of this versus, well, this is my Hebrew Bible here. all marked up because I've been studying this stuff. And what I always say is a lot of people who comment on the meaning of Genesis 1:1 regard to the age of the earth, a lot of the old earth people, unfortunately, they cannot read this. Okay, they comment on it and they say, well, the dictionaries say this word means this. I say, I don't care what the dictionary says. What does the Hebrew say? Read it to me and translate it. And they can't do it. So the question is, what does the scripture say versus what do the rocks say? Now, we pass around that little rock, and what that is, that's some granite diorite that we found in Kings Canyon. And it's kind of a granite, and the little black flecks in it. This is a picture of a photo from Drexel University. This little black flecks is a kind of mica called biotite, and the biotite mica inside the flakes. This is some of the actual sample that was used. This was some of the ones that was done, and I think this is from the San Diego area. I cannot remember the name of the pluton, but this was from that area. These black flakes are biotite mica, and inside those flakes are these tiny crystals called zircon, little tiny zircon crystals. I'll show you some pictures of them in a second. And those inside those zircon crystals was a very tiny radio center, a little tiny piece of very 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 tiny of uranium. And that can be used because the uranium goes through various different steps until it finally goes from uranium-238 all the way down to lead-206. The various different rates of radioactive decay can be used to determine the age of the rocks. Now, the oldest of these, this is not the oldest, but the oldest have dated these the zircon crystals to 4.5 billion years. That's a lot different from the about 10,000, maybe 10 to 15,000 years that the scriptures allow for to the flood. Most of this research goes back to the flood. There is one of them, however, that goes back to actually to creation. So I was asked the question, what are these stones to? That's the question that Joshua said that the descendants of those who crossed the Jordan would ask, you know, what do these stones mean to you? And I always think that that's a good way to kind of introduce this. So conformity, the question is in which direction? For the most part, science, secular science, wants to try to force evangelicals to conform to them. They're saying, you know, our science is incontrovertible, and you've got 4.5 million years, you've got this method of radioactive decay and so forth. But Ray challenged that. So should the text conform to science? Or should science conform to the text? And that's what the position of Ray. Now, this is just a little bit of a... This presentation covers a lot of different things. This is a little bit of literary theory. Here we have... I'm blocking everything. Come on over here. Here you see... This is the author of the text. He looks at an event, and then he considers his readers in order to write his text. That's the process that's involved. You got to keep that in mind. What happens if you say the different ideas for a text, how to read a particular text, is how should we read Genesis? As a creation narrative written in prose, that is, it's a narrative. Which is an erroneous, archaic account. That's the classical liberal approach, okay? The classical liberal approach. Or is it a creation myth written in poetry, which may be interpreted with great latitude? This is the classic view of the old earth, you know, old earth evangelicals. And then you have our view, of course, the right view. As a creation narrative written in prose, which is historically accurate. So those are the three basic ways you can read it. There might be slight variations, but those are the ways to read it. Now, if you read it this way, the earth is young. Now, at the end of my presentation, near the end, I'm going to be talking about my own particular research, but in which I I proved it. It's a narrative. That's one of the issues. So if you can prove it's a narrative, it eliminates this middle one, okay? And then it's a matter of, is it a creation narrative which is erroneous or a creation narrative which is historically accurate? So if you prove it's a narrative, it does eliminate this middle one right here. And this is another way of stating it. Is the text a narrative account which author believed to be an accurate historical record, but it does not represent reality? That's the classical liberal view, okay? It is a narrative. I think it's interesting that the classical liberal view, which is held by Hebraists, secular Hebraists, they understand, they look at that, they say, this is a narrative. You know, in fact, one of my my friends who are Hebraists, I've got some buddies that went to, got their doctorates, either at Hebrew Union or other places, they said, well, why are you doing this study to prove it's a narrative? We know it's a narrative. And so I said, well, because there's other view that people don't believe it's a narrative, okay? So that's what it is. So this is mythical, allegorical account meant to teach truth without witnessing historical events. That's a pretty pretty classic statement of the old earth evangelical position. It's meant to teach truth without witnessing the actual historical events, all right? And then what that means is, when you consider that you had the readers and the author and the event and the text, that means if this is true, then we don't know what actually happened, right? If this one is true, we don't know what actually happened. The only one that tells us what actually happened is if it's read this way, okay? So, let's continue. So the text informed the science. This is just a quote from, this is Galileo. Very famous quote. It's really true. It sounds like it's too contrived to be true, but it actually is. It was a letter he wrote to the Grand Duchess, Christina. And so he said, the Bible is to teach us how one goes to heaven, not how heaven goes. And then we have a statement by Galileo, which is very famous, and he says, nothing physical which sense experience sets before our eyes or which necessary demonstrations prove to us ought to be called in question upon the testimony of biblical passages which may have some different meaning beneath their words. On the contrary, having arrived at any certainties in physics, we ought to utilize these as the most appropriate aids in the true exposition of the Bible. Okay? In other words, science tells us how to interpret the Bible. Now, when I went to seminary, they never told us about that part of hermeneutics, that, you know, you use science to interpret the Bible. That was never there. Galileo didn't know about hermeneutics. And when I teach this in the college, I have these big no's that come up and everything, but we'll dispense with that. Here's another interesting quote by Bacon. For our Savior saith, you err not knowing the Scriptures from the power of God, laying before us two books or volumes to study, if we will be secured from error. First the Scriptures, revealing the will of God, and then the creatures expressing His power, in other words, science, whereof the latter is the key unto the former. And you can see that Bacon was wrong on this. He was wrong on a couple things. First of all, that text has nothing to do with what he's saying about it. This is all about. Jesus was responding to the Sadducees who gave him that test case. Remember of the seven brothers who all were married to the same, eventually all married the same woman, and then they all died, and then she died, and then they said, aha, now riddle this one for us, Jesus. Which one, you know, in resurrection, which one is she married to? Because they didn't believe in the resurrection. They thought this was a logical fallacy of resurrection. And his answer was, you err, not knowing the Scriptures nor the power of God. So Bacon is taking that statement and ripping it totally, what we call ripping it out of context and stripping it all its original meaning in order to get this statement here that the latter is the key unto the former, has nothing to do with that. So, but nevertheless, this has been an influential approach to the Scriptures. Okay. This is a quote by Kant, Immanuel Kant. Our age is the age of criticism to which everything must be subjected. The sacredness of religion and the authority of legislation are by many regarded as grounds of exemption from the examination of this tribunal. But if they are exempted, they become the subject of just suspicion and cannot lay claim to sincere respect, which reason accords only to that which has stood the test of a free and public examination. It was Kant's statement which said that the Bible must stand at the bar of human reason, not the other way around. And so we start to turn things around at this point with Kant. This is considered by Hazen Prusiner to be a classic statement of the Enlightenment position. Okay. But Proverbs 1:7a says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and that's what the Bible has to say, that knowledge bows to, and all kinds of knowledge. Notice it says here of knowledge, not just wisdom. That's Proverbs 9:10. This is Proverbs 1:7, which says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. So you don't even get on the bottom rung of the ladder, of knowledge, without a proper relationship and understanding of God. Okay, what is rate again? We come back to this. So it's conforming science to Scripture. They said, okay, we're going to go the other direction. We're going to conform science to Scripture. And so let's do a little, jump into a little bit of basic physics here, which is, I'm sure, what you were hoping for when you came to the camp, is to get a lesson in physics. We've got the three basic ideas of radiometric dating. We're going to talk about the ABCs of radiometric dating, some real basic stuff, the assumptions of radiometric dating, and then the challenges to radiometric dating. First of all, some ABCs. The idea of the way radiometric dating works is that you start with a parent element, uranium. Now, it doesn't have to be uranium. There's different kinds of radiometric dating. But the one that we're looking at in this particular case is going from uranium to lead. And the parent is the original element. And what happens is as it decays, because it's giving up either electrons or giving up, there's two kinds of decay. Alpha decay is giving up a helium nucleus, and there's beta decay, which gives up an electron. When it does that, it actually changes into another element, and it eventually goes down through a chain and becomes finally a stable atom. So an unstable atom converts into a stable atom through the process of nuclear decay. Now, another term we need to understand is half-life. That's the amount of time it takes for half of the parent element to turn into the daughter element. That's called the half-life. Okay, so parent to daughter and then half-life. Now, this is the specific reaction we're looking at. Unstable uranium-238 converts into stable lead-206 through the process of nuclear decay. And the half-life is 148,000 years at today's rates, okay? So you can understand that's how you get these incredibly long periods of time, 4.5 billion years. By the way, this is considered radioactive decay, and light speed are two of the main pillars of the old Earth position. So I think we've basically knocked this pillar down. So they're just they're just teetering on one pillar, and it's only a matter of time before we deal with light speed. But that seems to be more of a challenge. But we'll get it eventually. This is kind of a schematic. This is a simplified version of what happens in radioactive decay. Uranium going, giving off an alpha particle, which is a helium nucleus. Okay, which is has two protons and two neutrons. And then it goes to what happens is it grabs some electrons and then becomes helium, which is an inert gas. So uranium goes to that, and when that happens, it changes to thorium. It's no longer uranium, now it's thorium. And the next step, of course, it gives off another alpha particle, and now it's radium. And it keeps on going like this, gives another alpha particle. And it turns into radon. That's that radon gas that's collects in your basement. And then polonium. Now, polonium was in the news how long was that ago? About 6 months ago, a year ago? The KGB or whatever they have now in Russia killed somebody who was going to be a defector by getting him to ingest some polonium and fried his insides. Okay, so polonium then decays into lead. Now, this is simplified. This is what actually happens. It starts with uranium-238, and it goes down to thorium, and then it goes up this way. Whenever it moves up, it's beta decay. It's giving off an electron. And so it goes up to, I think it's pallium, and then uranium-234, and then down a different isotope of thorium, then radium, radon, polonium, one unstable lead, and then bismuth, and then polonium, another unstable lead, then bismuth, and then polonium, and eventually to a stable lead-206. That's what actually happens. Now, you'll notice in the process, one of the byproducts of the radioactive decay, besides eventually the lead, is helium. Okay, and that's what Rate focused on. They focused on a byproduct of radioactive decay that hadn't really been studied. That's the helium. Okay. So those are the ABCs of radiometric dating, and let's talk about some assumptions. First of all, first assumption, and these are assumptions. You need to understand that. Anybody who tells you, well, you know, you just say, well, all those things are assumptions. No way of proving it, because you can't go back 4.5 billion years or even 20,000 years. Now, the first assumption is that the ratio of parent to daughter is known. It's assumed that there was no daughter originally. But what if there was? You see, what if there was some lead along with the uranium? Well, that changes the dates. But they forget. They say, well, we can't worry about that. Let's just say there wasn't any lead. And then you get a lot older ages as a result. The second assumption is that there's no chemical mixing has occurred. No lead has come in from the outside at the end, which could also mess things up or the other way around. And finally, the rate of radioactive decay is a constant. It's interesting that most of these scientists will say, well, yeah, these are definitely assumptions, but this one, this is pretty certain. Although I've talked to physicists, one Christian physicist who was a young Earth, and he says there is a little known secret, and outside of the radiometric dating community, and that is they're afraid of the concept of non-constancy. They understand, these physicists understand, that this is an assumption, and there's absolutely no way to prove it. Okay? It's an assumption that it was a constant. Now, the first thing that Rate challenged was the idea of radioactive decay at all. Did large amounts of radioactive decay really happen? And they were hoping that that it didn't, but it did. So you have two possibilities, yes or no. They tested it by doing fission track studies and radio halo studies. The volcanic tuff is when ash is lithophized, when it turns into stone, and there's uranium in there, and it leaves when the uranium fissions, like an atomic bomb, when it fissions, when it breaks up, it leaves tracks. It leaves tracks in the tuff, and you can actually, if there's been a lot of decay, there'll be a lot of these tracks. So they were hoping there would be hardly any tracks, but they found huge numbers of tracks, and so that meant that there was a lot of radioactive decay. So they had to go on to the next level. Also, the radio halo studies, and I'll explain what a radio halo is. I'll explain it right now. What a radio halo is, when you have the radioactive decay occurring inside of a rock, when those alpha particles, which are helium nuclei, when they go out, they're going at a tremendous speed. They break up the rock, and you end up with a spherical discoloration around the radio center. And you can actually then slice through that, and you can tell by the size of that halo around, you can tell what element was inside to make that halo. You can tell because depending upon which element has different energies for the for the neutrons to go out. I mean, for the alpha particles to go out. So one of the same person, Andrew Snelling, who tested the fission track, said, I'm going to do radio halo studies. That was, it kind of was motivated by work by Bob Gentry on radio halos, and he picked up where Gentry had left off, and Bob Gentry is a Christian, and he thought the radio halos were created on, were created in place by, you know, by the Lord at creation. And Andrew showed that that's not the case, and that the radio halos were, did actually happen in the, you know, after creation. So I'll show you some pictures of radio halos in a minute. In any case, those experiments showed there was evidence for extensive amounts of radioactive decay. And so then that, what's the next step? Fission tracks and zircon crystals and the uranium radio halos and zircon crystals showed that there was large amounts of radioactive decay. So here's our question again. Did large amounts of radioactive decay really happen, yes or no? The answer is yes, it really did happen. Okay? So now, Reid said, okay, it really did happen. Then the other answer has to be that we had accelerated decay. And so now they're looking for the evidence for accelerated decay. Now, they didn't cook any of the data. They just looked at the data, and it came up with the results they did. So we've established by fission track studies and radio halo studies that there was extensive amounts of radioactive decay. Now, is the radioisotopic method of dating valid? That's the second question. And so yes or no, we're going to ask that question again. We're going to test it, okay, by several means. By isochron studies, by using all four methods. And what, let me explain what an isochron study is. Isochron study, there are, Steve Austin found, there's a place in the Grand Canyon called the diabase sill. And the all the rocks in that layer are all the same age. And so what he did was he tested by four different methods. He used, I'm trying to remember them now, strontium, thorium, he used uranium lead, and he used, what is it now, neodymium, can't remember the thing. But it is, he used four different methods, and you would expect, since the rock is the same age, you would get the same, samarium neodymium, that's what it was, samarium neodymium, and you would get the same age. Well, he found that these four different methods on the same rock, even with using the very sophisticated way, using isochron studies, got hugely different ages and way outside the error bars of the method. So that shows right there that there's a major problem. You should have all the same age of those rocks. I mean, the rock is a certain age, right? And regardless of how you test it, it should come up with the age, and this shows us some kind of problem with the method. Now, no one had ever done this before. No one had ever tested a rock with four different methods, the same rock. And the interesting thing about the Reid research is that it's all pioneering research. And Reid's been criticized. People said, well, you know, show us in the literature where somebody else has done this. We say, well, we can't because it's all pioneering research. You follow us and you do it, and you'll get the same results, okay? We're the pioneers here, or let's say these guys are. In fact, all these guys, with their work in physics and geophysics and geology, they all should have gotten the Nobel Prize for physics and geology. No question about it. The work that it's all this pioneering research. At the end, I'll show you all the things they found. It is incredible. So this idea of testing the method. Now, all the work that was done, all the testing, was done at labs outside of ICR. It had nothing to do with ICR. These were world-class labs that did not know they were doing the work for ICR. We were just paying them, a certain amount of money, do this test. Okay, we'll do the test. And that's the way it works. And we knew which labs were the best, in the world, and who would stand behind their work, and others would say, you know, that lab its work is impeccable. So no one could say, well, you did this in your own lab. You know, you're just cooking the data. No, we sent it out and paid for it, and donors sent in money to pay for things like that. And it was all these things were done at world-class labs around the world. who stand behind their work. Most of them, all but one, actually have allowed their name to be mentioned. One guy said, "You're not going to mention my name. If you mention my name as connected with you guys, I'm going to sue you." So we can't mention his name. All right, so the method of, is the method of radioisotopic dating valid? It seems to be a question here, at least, so I think we should say no at this point. And testable isotope studies using all four methods. That's why we get that. Okay, are the assumptions valid? Yes or no? We're going to test these assumptions by several experiments. Helium retention, carbon-14 dating of coal and diamonds, and polonium radio halos. This is where it really gets fascinating, and it gets a little bit hairy at the same time. It's kind of like the corners of the tabernacle. Okay, tested by helium retention. Now, these slides that I'm going to show you are the actual ones, not this one, but the actual presentations of the individual physicists and geophysicists and geologists. So the first one regarding the evidence for young age, helium retention of zircon crystals. And so these are the evidence for young age, carbon-14 and coal and diamonds. These are actual chapters in the rate book. And then a stunning new discovery in physics and geology, accelerated decay. So let's take a look. Accelerated decay, large amounts of decay in a short period of time. Now, when's it going to, radio halos, polonium radio halos. I will show you what they look like in just a second. Here they are. This is what a polonium radio halo looks like. And this is what a radio halo looks like. All Andrew has done here is sliced through the, this destruction layer is in the biotite. He has, you can see where the outer ring is, and by that you can tell what the, you know, what the radio center is right in the middle there. And the interesting thing about polonium is polonium it has a very, very short half-life, okay? And yet it takes hundreds of thousands or millions of decays to produce one of these radio halos, okay? If you have a short half-life, how is that possible that you get a radio halo with polonium? Well, Bob Gentry said, well, God created them in place, Andrew found that they were coming from uranium slightly down. See this crack here? Down the crack. And what was happening is the uranium, as you saw on that chain, eventually gets down to polonium. Now, once it's polonium, the polonium is highly radioactive. It's giving off its stuff, but it has such a short half-life. The only way it can keep on producing a radio halo is if it's constantly being resupplied and made from the uranium. Now, what that means is if this has to decay this is a very short half-life, that means that the uranium has to be decaying at an incredibly rapid rate in order to supply this polonium. This is the most powerful, in my opinion, the most powerful argument for accelerated decay. It's staring us right in the face, but it's a little esoteric to understand this one. But since the polonium comes from the uranium, and it's the only place it can come from, okay, then the uranium has to be decaying very rapidly into polonium, produce the polonium, in order to get this this radio halo around here. And I've got some more pictures here, where you can actually see how that the uranium. I guess this is the uranium halo. I'm not sure which one is which, to be honest with you. But it is. Here's the uranium halo, and here's the polonium. It has to be coming from the uranium. And when I said it was a short half-life, I wasn't kidding. Notice that, remember the half-life of uranium was 148,000 years, something like that. Now, look at this one, okay? Polonium 218, 3.1 minutes, okay? Polonium 210, 138, and polonium 214, these are just different atomic weights. 164 microseconds. That's extremely short time. A microsecond is, a millionth of a second. So 164 microseconds, and yet we find halos of polonium-214 because it's got a different energy level. We can tell which that it was 214. This is a statement from Andrew Snelling. It takes from 100 million to 1.5 billion alpha particles to form a radio halo. And the only source for that is the uranium at the center of the zircon is the only possible source of the polonium and must be constantly resupplying it. This is a very powerful argument for accelerated decay. It's the only possible answer to the resupplying of the polonium. Okay? So it's a little bit hairy, but the uranium will no longer be able to resupply the polonium after the granite is cooled. That's another thing. This is something that the geologists are saying, that all of this had to happen while the granite is still molten. Once it has cooled, the uranium can't move anymore down the crack. So all this stuff has to happen in a very short period of time while the granite is cooling. Now, how long does it take granite to cool? Well, the geologists, know these things, how long it takes these things to cool. And so they can give them an idea of the age of these rocks. The uranium must be decaying extremely rapidly, and the granite must be cooling extremely rapidly for this to happen. And what he said was the rate of uranium-238 decay must have been accelerated by a factor of at least 100 million. I was off when I said 100,000. 100 million for this one, in order to for this to happen. That's what you need, 100 million to get the polonium-214. Now, so that's the first challenge to radiometric dating. We have the isochronic discordance and the helium retention and zircon. We're going to look at those now. The helium retention and zircon, very interesting. These are slides done by Russell Humphreys, D. Russell Humphreys, Ph.D. He was at the Sandia National Laboratory. This guy's no slouch. He's brilliant. Russ Humphreys is brilliant. And so helium experiments give nuclear evidence for a young world. And because he was at Sandia Laboratory, he was able to pay for real nice, pay for a graphic artist to do his work. 1.5 billion years of nuclear decay occurred between 4,000 and 14,000 years ago. And we think that that's probably at the flood. Okay, and the radioactivity makes helium. Now, he's got a much more sophisticated picture than I have. But you can see one of the byproducts of the you end up with 8 helium atoms in the course from going from uranium-238 down to lead 206. And the tiny zircon, this is the zircon crystals. These are only 0.75 microns, very, very tiny. They contain uranium and thorium atoms. They come from this location near Los Alamos. This is the Los Alamos geothermal site in Fenton Hill, New Mexico. It gets pretty... His analysis is what he's going to do. He's going to determine how long it takes for the helium, should long for take for the helium to diffuse, that is to wiggle out of the crystal structure of the zircons. And since helium is it's an inert gas. It doesn't form compounds with anything. And as a result, what happens is, as he says, it's very slippery, lightweight, fast-moving, and slippery. Wiggles through the crystal, leaks through cracks around crystals. Now, there are experimenters that work with their interest is how gas diffuses from different substances at different temperatures. And what Russ thought figured out was we can determine by the amount of helium that is in the zircon crystals. We can determine by that the age of when that the age of those zircon crystals, when that helium started coming out, and it's a function of temperature. It turns out it's a function of temperature. The helium should diffuse fast and leak fast, what he calls the helium leak rate. And so what he did was he took a a zircon crystal. They put helium in it. I don't know how they did that, but they put helium in it. They heated it up to a certain temperature and saw what the rate was of diffusion of the gas. Very sophisticated experimentation, but the guy did it over and over and over again. Got a certain rate, and then all that Russ had to do was say, "Well, how much helium do we have in the, you know, how much helium do we actually have in the zircon crystals that we found?" And you can determine the age. So it's an alternative geochronometer. And based simply upon temperature and diffusion rates, nothing very sophisticated compared to radioisotopic decay. So he was working with a different byproduct of radioisotopic decay rather than the daughter. He's working with helium. Now, what's really interesting about this is before he did these experiments, what he did was he did mathematical computations of what the rate would have to be if evolution was correct and what the rate would have to be if creation was correct. He published those rates, okay? And he says, okay, I'm sticking my neck, and you never do this, okay? He stuck his neck out and said, now we're going to run the test. I already have a published paper which says that the evolution model is this, the creation model is this, and let's just see now where the data, you know, falls, okay? And, you know, well, what happened was absolutely amazing. The data are right here, okay? These points are the actual data, and you can see they lie right along the creation model line right here, right along the curve. And so new zircon data agree resoundingly with the creationist timescale. This is only off by a factor of about 100,000, the evolutionary model. It's way, way off. Not even close. And the experimenter, who I cannot mention, the experimenter says that he stands by this data, okay? He stands by the data, but he says the conclusions are wrong. He says there's got to be something wrong, but I know my experimentation was correct. Everything I did was right. The data is right. Everything is right, but your conclusions have to be wrong because the Earth is old, okay? And he will not allow his name to be mentioned. So we have two zircon clocks. They disagree by millions, okay, of helium diffusion, 4,000 to 14,000 years. And I tend to push this a little bit more toward the 14,000 because of the evidence of ancient civilizations and stuff like that. But that could be worked with. But nuclear decay, 1.5 billion years. And in the DVD, it's really nice. It shows how the sand, it's like sand going through an hourglass, how the nuclear decay is going very, very fast at the same time as the helium diffusion is going. These processes are going at the same time. And so there has to be a nuclear decay rate change in the past. And in the DVD, there's like a little valve here that the Lord opened up and for the rate of decay to increase tremendously in order to speed it up. Now, why do we think it was at the flood? Well, because you've got a lot of water that is protecting the people on the ark, you know, from this radioactive decay. Otherwise, it would vaporize them because of the heat factor. But there's other things that they're working on that problem. The heat problem is an issue. Okay. Radium diffusion experiments support the young biblical timescale. Evidence for accelerated nuclear decay, recently evidence against uniform nuclear dating. So that is the one experiment. Now, this guy should have gotten the Nobel Prize for Physics for this. This is an amazing thing, but it doesn't happen. Carbon-14. This is John Baumgartner. He's retired. He's a geophysicist. He was at Los Alamos National Laboratory in the research division, which is the most prestigious research division in the country. He is so smart, John, that when he, just after he got his PhD, they said, you come to work for us, we'll let you spend half of your time on your creation research, as long as you just give us half of your time, and we'll pay you full time. But you can do half of you spend all your time half of the time on creation research. John Baumgartner has developed the Terra model for earthquake prediction, modeled the surface of the Earth mathematically. It's incredible, and he's just a brilliant man. I remember when we were at the rate meeting, and we had tested various different substances. We had tested coals for carbon 14. The idea, somebody threw out this idea. They said, "Well, you know, the rate project really is looking at what are called heavy metal radioisotopes. We're not really looking at carbon 14, but let's just try it." And I was sitting there, and so they got this really good results with coal. And so John said, "Well, why don't we just try diamond? You know, it's probably not going to find anything. We'll just try diamonds." Well, they found carbon 14 in diamond, and that's worthy of what, 10 Nobel prizes. So the carbon 14 dating demolishes the possibility of macroevolution. And these are long slides, but the idea is that was very highly sensitive device was used to test for carbon 14, and carbon 14 is in all living substances, and then carbon 14 is taken in while you breathe and so forth, and contaminates all creatures. One out of every trillion carbon atoms in your body is radioactive, but don't worry about that, it's a small amount. And when a creature dies, the carbon 14 slowly decreases, and by determining the amount of carbon 14, it's possible to determine the age that creature died. This is a schematic of the was done in Vienna, the environmental research accelerator that was done for the experiment. There it is right there. That's an accelerator mass spectrometer. There's the physicist. Now, you know that guy doesn't make mistakes. Look at him. You know he doesn't make mistakes. And so he's the one who stands behind his work for carbon-14. They have said about him that the fact he found carbon-14 in diamond means he must not have washed his hands before he did the research. Did you think that guy didn't wash his hands before he did his research? I mean, this guy's really incredibly careful. This is interesting, the absolute age limitation for carbon-14. It turns out that this is interesting, after 40 half-lives of 229,000 years, the amount of carbon-14 is diminished by a factor of 1 half to the 40th. This is 10 to the minus 10 smaller than the AMS detection limit. Look at this statement here. If the entire mass of the universe was carbon-14, after 1.5 million years, there would not be even a single atom of it remaining. Now, of course, the whole mass of the universe is not carbon-14. So the whole point is this. We shouldn't find any carbon-14 at all if the Earth is, 4.5 billion years old, or if these things are as old as they say. We shouldn't find any carbon-14 that's way, 10 to the minus 79th, is rather small number. And so there should be nothing left, no carbon-14 remaining at all. And yet we find it. This is the amounts of carbon-14, what's called percent modern carbon, for various different materials. Now, he found this in the literature, okay? This is in the literature already, buried, just as the original substances were buried. They buried this in the literature because nobody wanted this to be found. That they were getting carbon-14 in these substances, and we're not supposed to have any carbon-14. Not supposed to have any carbon-14 in calcite or marble, okay, or shell. Not supposed to have carbon-14 in that or coal. Carbon-14 in coal, okay. We're even going to check oil, but then they say, well, let's just really jump for it and go for diamond. But the percent modern carbon. Another interesting thing about this. Is all of these substances, all the coals particularly, had the same percentage of modern carbon, which means that all that coal was formed at the same time. I wonder when that was. The flood, of course. And you have the carbon-14 carbon ratios measured in Phanerozoic. The geologists love these kind of terms. Phanerozoic. It means fossil-bearing samples. Percent modern carbon. And it says an important aspect of the evidence is that most of it has been obtained by secular scientists, has already been published in the standard peer-reviewed radiocarbon literature. That's good bedtime reading, the standard radiocarbon literature. The motivation for such extensive analysis sample deemed carbon-14 dead, and publication of the results has been to identify and eliminate presumed contamination in these procedures. So they refer to the carbon-14 as contamination, but most admit the carbon-14 is intrinsic to their samples, and most further admit they have no explanation for its origin. Where does it come from? That they're trying to figure this carbon-14. It says it just can't be there. According to our theories, the Earth is old. It can't be there. Why is it there? Well, it's because the Earth isn't old. The RAE team selected 10 samples from the U.S. Department of Energy Coal Sample Bank maintained at Penn State University, this goes to all the details of how it was collected. But all of the percent modern carbon are all at about the same age, you can see this, and have sort of increased the confidence level in the published carbon-14 levels and to confirm that the variation in the values across the fossil-bearing part of the record is surprisingly small. So it shows that they all are about the same time. The case that intrinsic carbon-14 at levels in the range 0.1 to 0.5% of modern carbon exists in all pre-ice age fossil organic materials now appears to be an all but established scientific fact. That is worthy, right there, of a Nobel Prize. In a report released just 2 weeks ago, Radiocarbon Lab finds levels of carbon-14 in South African diamonds. Now, this has been duplicated in another lab, nothing to do with ICR. This work was done vaporizing the diamond. That's the only way they could figure out to do it. Another lab did it, wanted to jump in on it, because this kind of thing, they know that they're going to eventually get, somebody knows they're going to get a Nobel Prize for physics on this, okay? So the labs are jumping in on this, and so they said, well, we're going to try to embed the diamond without crushing it and vaporizing it in the target. Well, they were able to do it, and they also found carbon-14 in the diamond. And they're thinking, well, we did it, and we washed our hands, okay? In other words, we were really careful to make sure there's no contamination, and yet these other experiments are getting carbon-14 in diamond. Absolutely amazing. The presence of reproducible carbon-14 well above the accelerator mass spectrometer instrument threshold levels in essentially every Precambrian sample reported in the literature suggests that these samples contain primordial carbon-14. This implies that the physical Earth itself must be only thousands, you know, like between 4,000 as opposed to billions of years old, because all geologists recognize that diamonds come from very early in Earth history, okay? So with diamonds, we're going back to very ancient, you know, and this obviously represents an extremely exciting research opportunity for young Earth creationists. The carbon-14 data provides some of the clearest radioisotopic evidence yet for a few thousand-year age for the fossil record. These data also provide strong support for uniform age for all but the topmost part of the record. So are the assumptions valid? We looked at the assumptions. No. Tested by helium retention, tested by carbon-14 dating of coal and diamonds, and by polonium radio halos. Which all shows that the assumptions of constant rate is not valid. Let me just mention one other experiment that was actually another experimenter. He was our theoretical physicist, Gene Chaffin. And when he would start talking about the way in which God had to go into the atom and change the way the potential well in the atom worked in order to accelerate decay, our eyes would start to glaze over. He'd be talking about these things, and all of us wouldn't quite understand it. But he has established a new kind of physics for the atom and the changing the potential function, and says it's possible that we can have accelerated decay without destroying the universe. In other words, it's possible to do that. Again, that's Nobel Prize-worthy work, all of that. Now, what was my little contribution? Well, my contribution was to look at the text of Genesis and say, which of these three is, based upon the Hebrew, which one is it? Okay? Which of these three is it? And so what I did was, I'm just going to go through this fast. I said the text itself will tell us how we should read it, The author can't help of a text cannot help but give us clues on how we should read the text. I have a lot more to say about that, but I don't have time. So how do you distinguish poetry from prose? Well, I'm not going to go into all that. The difficulties are there's no word for poetry in biblical Hebrew. The terms used for biblical Hebrew poetry are used in, there's all kinds of problems, okay? Don't worry about all that. But we have to find it out. And so I thought, well, what can I do? What's something I can count and compare poetry and narrative in order to do it? And so I had these possibilities. I thought, one possibility is the verb types, the distribution of verbs. Another would be to go a little more sophisticated and look at sequences of verbs, maybe look at syntax structures, clause length, uses of the relative position. These various different ways I've thought about doing it, and I'm basically lazy, and so I thought, well, this is the way I'll do it because it's the easiest thing. These are much more difficult, and when I worked with a statistician, he said it's a good thing because this is the only one the statistics can handle anyway at this point. So don't worry about that. So this is the name of the chapter that I wrote in the Rate book, Statistical Determination of Genre in Biblical Hebrew, Evidence for Historical Reading of Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. And so we use morphological distribution. We're going to count a particular kind. We're going to look at finite verbs, and these are the four finite verbs in Hebrew, the vayaktol, katal, vakatal, and yiktol. So what we did was we asked these questions. Does the finite verb distribution in biblical Hebrew vary with genre? In other words, do I get a different count if I look at poetry versus narrative? Okay, that's one question. If it does, is it sufficiently different that I can use it to predict what kind of, once I know the verb count, can I use it to predict what kind of genre it is, narrative versus poetry? That's what it was about. And then the implications, if it's narrative, did the biblical authors believe they're writing about real events? So those were the three questions I dealt with in the research. This is the way, actually, that the statisticians insisted that I write this. This was the way I thought was okay. And then they said, no, that's not specific enough. So we came up with this. This is the model we used, the statistician, a logistic regression and classification model. Does not just bless you. The model is derived from the relative frequency of preterites. Preterites are the same as vayaktol. Classify text by genre no better than random results. That's what's called the null hypothesis, and the experiment showed that the null hypothesis is wrong, and therefore we get what's called the alternative hypothesis. That is that there's a logistic regression classification model derived from the relative frequency of vayaktol, which classifies text by genre better than random results. Now, there's different phases of the research. The first phase was very early in my involvement with the Rate Project. I presented my results just with a picked sample. Now, this is not statistically valid because I had picked it, okay? The only way it can be statistically valid is if it's a random sample. But you'd want to do this first to see whether or not your research is even worth pursuing. So I picked the sample, and 14 narrative texts, 14 poetry texts, and ran, this is all the different things we went through. This is what the distribution looks like in narrative. The green, that's the preterists, so the vayaktol forms. And you don't have to be a Hebraist or anything to see there's a big difference between this, which is narrative, and that, which is poetry. Okay? Now, when I showed this to the great guys, and these are really, they're staid, pretty quiet, guys, geologists, geophysicists, physicists, not kind of people that are jumping around. Well, one of them got out of his chair and started going like this, because he understood the significance of this. I didn't understand this. That what this meant was that the statistical evidence was so strong that we were going to be able to show that this was narrative. And once you show it's narrative, then you have to do is show that narratives are historical and you're home free. Well, this became a slide that has become pretty famous because what I did was I compared the distribution in texts, Exodus 14, Exodus 15, it's talking about the same event, but one is in narrative and one is in poetry. Here's Judges 4 and Judges 5. Remember when Jael gave Sisera a really bad headache, put a tent peg through his head, remember that? That's the narrative account, and this is the poetry account. And here we have Genesis 1, 1 through 2, 3, and I picked Psalm 104, which is a poetic account of creation, okay? So John Morris would use this in his talks, and Larry Vardaman, they all use this thing in their talks, and it also appears in the Ray chapter. This is called paired data, 3D plot of paired texts. These are just some groupings showing, I can't show you all this stuff, it's just too much, but this is for the PIC data. Let me keep on moving. This was very interesting. This was a plot that was suggested by Roger Longbotham, who is my first statistician. I ended up with two of them, making sure that my results were correct. What he did was he put all the data into the computer and then said, is there any evidence of clustering? Now, he didn't tell the computer what was poetry and what wasn't, okay, what was narrative and what was poetry. He just said, well, see if there's any clustering based upon the numbers of verbs, these relative frequencies. And the computer found this. He says there's clear clustering here, and then we have a double cluster down here. And these turn out to be all the narrative texts. You notice there's no narratives down here. All the narratives beautifully clustered together. And then he said to me, he says, now what is the meaning of this double cluster down here under poetry? I said, I have no idea. This is one of those surreptitious things that happens in research. I mean, that's an avenue for future research, but it does show the clustering that we were onto something, okay? Now, this was the plot that Roger did called a logistic curve for the PIC data, or a few more. And he says, now, you understand, when we work with the random data, we're not going to get this steep of a curve, he didn't think. Because this is almost a square wave, and over here this is the probability that something is basically poetry, and the probability that's narrative is up here. It turns out that Genesis 1:1 through 2:3 is way out here. Okay, but since it's PIC data, it's not statistically valid, but was very interesting, and the guys were jumping out of their chairs when they saw this stuff. Now we go to the confirmatory phase, is when we actually have a random sampling. I grouped all the texts in the Hebrew Bible I didn't look at the Hebrew, of course. I just went by whether it appeared to be a story or a poem. I grouped them all, and I by email threw them all at the statistician, and he ran a random number generator, and he just picked. He picked a bunch of texts just totally randomly, and now we're dealing with something we can work with statistics. 97 texts, 48 narrative, 49 poetry out of the 522 texts that occur in the Old Testament. 295 narrative, 227 poetry. So we went through all these different steps. Don't worry about that. And all this stuff is, okay, let's go through all this stuff. You want to get to the charts. All right, this is what, now we're dealing with statistically valid data because it's random samples. And here, this is the results, the morphological distribution in narrative. And you can see the prominence of the green. And here we go. You ready for this? This is what is in poetry. Okay, now let's do that again. All right. Huge difference, and they all recognized that it was a huge. Again, I was starting to dawn on me how significant these results were. And here we have some grouping, some plots and stuff that more plots that I did. What I want to get to is this plot, which actually occurs in the book, and I did this plot, and it shows the median that is half above and half below for narrative. That's the blue line here for narrative, and here's the blue line for poetry for those texts. It shows that definitely genre does determine the distribution. the distribution of verbs. That was very significant, and so that's published in the chapter. Now, we went from population to a random sample, and this is what the curve looked like for that random sample. And you can see it's still very steep. Anything over here is classified as poetry. Over here is classified as narrative, and this will give a probability of a text being a narrative. Here's Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. That's only for comparison purposes because the random sample by design did not include Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. I didn't realize it was still another step. Okay, the statisticians would always tell us, "Oh, there's another step now," this is the model on the accuracy out of 48 poetic texts. The model, that logistic regression model, classified out of 49 texts, classified 48 of them correctly and missed on one. And on the 48 narrative, it classified 47 correctly and missed on one. Well, I was disappointed because it had missed. And the statistician told me, he says, if you had 100%, no one would have believed your research. They would have thought you had cooked the data. Because he says, usually we're dealing with like 70%, 60, 70% accuracy. He says, you've got 98% accuracy here. You know, don't worry about this. You know, don't be upset about this. We have to move from estimation. We have to move from the statistics level, which is on the random sample, to the level of the population. And that's done mathematically by determining the parameters and all these mathematical stuff and extending the analysis to text outside the sample. Now, this is how we did it. Quickly, we want to now extrapolate back to the whole population because that's where Genesis 1:1 through 2:3 is. It's back up here, okay? It's in this population. It's not here. I said by statistical design, it cannot be. So what we have to do is we have to imagine mathematically all the possible out of this number of texts, 295 and 227, all the possible blocks, 97 texts, how this could be distributed. And, of course, there's millions of these different possibilities, but mathematically this can be done. And during this research, Roger Longbotham, he went from a position of a kind of an independent statistical consultant to becoming a statistician with Amazon. Well, once he became a statistician with Amazon, they gave him the gold standard of statistical programs called SAS. And the things he could do with it, he says, now I can do things I couldn't do before for you. And so what he did was, I won't worry about this stuff. What he did was, he said, we can calculate at a 95% confidence interval or a 99.5% confidence interval all the possible bands for this thing. Now with these possible bands, and he says, I will give you the extremes bands, you know, on the left and right. And he was thinking that it would be a really wide curve, that this would be kind of a wide sweeping thing. But when he actually ran it, he says it's really narrow. And then here we've got the Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. Now it's valid to put that on there, and we can read the probability off. With a confidence of 99.5% for the probability that the text is a narrative, the range of probability for Genesis 1:1 through 2:3 at 99.5% confidence level is 0.999942 to 0.999987. Okay? Folks, that means it's a narrative. Okay, this is a powerful statistical argument. It is statistically indefensible to argue that this text is poetry. It's indefensible. And you know, then what I did was I adduced 15 proofs. We don't have time to go through them, but these 15 observations on a way in which the biblical authors believe they were writing about real history. All of these. Let me just talk about just one, which I think is the most significant. Number 14. The biblical authors time words challenge ancient readers to valid historical claims made in the text. You will find things like this written in the text. Atagom Hazeh. You can see that until this day, Joshua or Samuel or whatever, or Moses, challenging his readers. Go out there, like in the case of Joshua. Go out there, go to the caves, you'll find the caves, you pull the stones back, and you'll find those king's skeletons in there that we executed. You'll find them there to this day. So what he's doing is he's sticking his neck way out and saying, okay, you can check on it. I challenge you to check on the historical reality of this. Now, if this author didn't believe in the historicity of what he was writing was really true, he'd be crazy to make statements like this. But there are many of these instances where they will say, this is the way it is until this day. There's 15 of them. If you want to, you can read them in the Ray chapter and in the new book that's coming out, Biblical Authority in the Age of the Earth. There is I have a chapter in there in which I discuss these as well. So at least 10 of them anyway. Okay, let's try to pull this together. Okay. This is an interesting quote here. This is by a Jewish literary scholar and Bible scholar, Meir Sternberg. He says, if as seekers for the truth, professional or amateur, we can take or leave the truth claims of inspiration, then as readers we must simply take it, just like any of the other biblical premises or conventions, from the existence of God to the sense borne by specific words, or else invent our own text. He is holding us to a standard. He's saying, if you believe in inspiration, and the biblical authors are clearly believing that what they're writing is historical, then you must believe, if you believe in inspiration, you must believe this is historical. If it's a narrative, it's historical, and therefore when that's applied to Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, it also is historical. If you believe in inspiration. Interesting. All right, now let's kind of tie this together. Literalness of the text goes to a young earth. Radioisotopic decay at today's rates leads to an old earth. And Rate's conclusions, there are four of them. Extensive amounts of radioactive decay has occurred in the past. A previously unknown phenomenon, accelerated decay, has occurred in the past. Dates obtained by radioisotopic dating methods, therefore, are highly inaccurate. And the biblical Hebrew text of Genesis 1 through 11 should be read as a veridical historical account. Veridical is misspelled, should be with a D. But I would prefer now to say a literal historical account anyway. And the Bible is trustworthy in all matters of which it speaks. Now, these are the pioneering research, then, that Ray was involved in. Applying all four radioisotopic dating methods to the same rock unit. That was done by Steve Austin. An exhaustive study of polonium radio halos by Andrew Snelling. The development of an alternative geochronometer from a previously ignored byproduct of radioactive decay, helium, by measuring the helium leak rate as a function of temperature. That was Russ Humphreys. The application of carbon-14 dating techniques to diamonds, John Baumgartner. Development of new nuclear decay models to account for accelerated decay, that's Gene Chaffin. And then the development of a statistical tool to classify biblical Hebrew texts according to genre. All pioneering research and in the Ray Project. The Lord tremendously blessed the project. You can read, the book is available, there's a layman's version, but I would suggest you start with a DVD. That's the easiest way to understand the Rate project. That's it.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the thinking on the mechanism?
Pardon me?
What's the thinking on the mechanism?
The mechanism of accelerated decay?
What accelerated the rate of decay? What's the thinking on that?
The Gene Chaffin has suggested that if we change the nuclear potential in the nucleus from I think it's apparently a fairly simple, I guess it's a kind of a square well, to ones that has nodes on it, a different type of potential function, then you can have accelerated decay. He's working with the idea that there's certain physical constants that would have had to change. And the physical constants can change without affecting life processes, amazingly. So I think it's the fine structure constant or something like that. I don't know which one it is, but one of them can change The polonium decay can only happen if you have accelerated decay. That's the only possible explanation for that. So even if we don't understand the mechanisms, and I think Gene is moving in on them, even if we don't exactly understand the mechanisms, I think still it happened. So now it's up to physicists to deal with that fact, to accept it rather than trying to looking at the research and say it doesn't fit our models. Physicists in the past have said, okay, it doesn't, the research is saying our model is wrong. We need to change our model. I mean, they changed from Newtonian mechanics to quantum physics and quantum to quantum electrodynamics and then general relativistic quantum electrodynamics. I mean, why not change the model? Well, because changing the model changes their whole understanding of the age of the Earth and also challenges the unchallengeable evolution. It's all a matter, I think, that they're not willing to change the model, but the research stands. I think it's just going to take some time, but eventually there will be those who will duplicate the research and it will be acknowledged at that time, and then maybe they'll be willing to change models. I don't know. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Dave. Okay. He used my name?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So I was listening to the debate. Of course, I was applying for you. But anyways, how can he said that, of course, the NIV translator guy, I can't remember what his name, the doctor, whatever, who says y'all is not consistent with day four. It could be longer, long day, a certain amount of time. What is your interpretation of that?
Yom is a day. Since it's a narrative, it's actually a pretty simple answer. Because I've established that the genre is narrative, we should understand the yom and where it occurs. It occurs in other narratives, in other narratives we're not talking about yom being a billion years someplace else, and also the fact that we have the sequence of days. We have an ordinal accompanying yom, so we have the second day, third day, fourth day. All of those things suggest the objection to day four is that I actually have a whole PowerPoint on the fourth day of creation. The objection to day four is that how can you have light on day one before there's a source of light? Well, the answer is God is the source of light. I think it's also polemical because the sun was believed to be so significant in the ancient Near East, was believed to be a god, and definitely the creation account is inveighing against the sun. It's really going against the sun and the moon as being gods. That's one of the things you got to realize in the creation account is it has a theological purpose. It's attacking other views of that day, the Egyptian cosmology and cosmogony, and also the Mesopotamian as well. So, but Yom, as most Hebraists would say, well, it's a narrative, therefore it means what it means elsewhere. Yom is a day. It doesn't mean an age. Okay, yes?
In your plotting, you had two points that seem to consistently fall outside of where
you were expecting them. Yeah, they're outliers.
Are they just poetry that reads as prose or very poetic?
No, what it is this. Exodus 33 was one of the texts that I picked as I just said, well, it's a story about the Lord appearing to Moses and to them. This is a narrative. Of course, I didn't look at the verbs when I picked the text. If I had done that, that would have been circular. And so I picked it, and it turns out that there are a lot of what are called there's a lot of vocative forms in that, because a lot of the a lot of that text is telling us about the things that Moses would habitually do. He did it over and over again. He would go out to the tent of meeting, and this is what the Lord would do, and this is what Moses would do, and that's the whole thing about him covering his face with a veil and all of that. See, at the same time, the vakatal is used for future. So when the Lord would say, I will do this and I will do that, there's all those vakatals. So when I checked with a statistician, I said, is there any kind of correlation between the number of vakatals and the vayaktols, which are the kind of the standard narrative verb form? And I'm talking along with him on the phone and so forth. He says, I've got your answer. And he says, there's a very strong correlation, a negative correlation. As the number of vakatals go up, the vayaktols drop. And he says, this is the reason why the model identified this as poetry when in fact it's narrative. The other text is Ezekiel 19, which I had identified. I said, this is poetry. But actually what it is, it's apocalyptic. It's not even the same group, because it identifies the two kings, Jehoahaz and Jehoiakim, and talks about them as lions. Now, kings are not lions. So this is a highly symbolic language, and I misidentified the text. And that's the reason why there's those two outliers. What's interesting about it and what the statistician said is the model caught it. And so he says, so the model works. The fact that it, it caught those things is an indication that it's a really good statistical model. And the accuracy, as I said, at 99.5%, incredible accuracy of that model to the actual data.